This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today I have with me...
Arnie Evans.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Arnie, your time in broadcasting, there were various things that you covered at that stage.
There was a lot of change going on because it was, of course, pre and then post Rogernomics.
Yeah, 1984,
Actually, all of that stuff was happening a bit before Longy and
so
the
some
fourth
of it
Labour
started
government
under Muldoon.
Oh. Yes, and in fact, I think one of the big keys for it was our changing relationship. This is kind of appropriate at the time with Brexit and everything, but it was our changing relationship with England, with home, that set off a lot of it. For example, I covered freezing works after freezing works closure, starting with Patea and Gear Meat down in Wellington and eventually Longford.
So these were all under Muldoon.
They were all caused by the EEC rules requiring huge upgrades. Oh. And the freezing works in those days were pretty much owned by English people.
Okay.
And they weren't willing to go through this expense. They were going to modernize and go to a more modern system with around the clock and stuff and so forth. So you got all those closing and things like Takapau and O'Ringi opening up instead.
So when you say by English, you mean overseas English?
Right, yes. One of the biggest, I can't remember the names of them now, one of the biggest was actually started as a conglomeration, I don't know how long it survived that way, of English butchers trying to guarantee a meat supply.
Okay.
And then there was Vestey's, which was a British thing, was the other big one.
And also the English unionists coming out here and causing all the industrial relations issue.
Although our enfant terrible that way was a chap named Roger Middlemas, who was very much a local. I can remember Roger was very good copy because he would be much more frank with you than anybody else would. I remember when Longbourn was
and he was with what? Meat workers
union? He was a meat workers union, yes. Mm-hmm. I can remember when Longbourn was closing down saying to him, "This place has been losing money for 10 years. Why is it still open?" And he said, "Well, the people who will make the decision are still getting their paychecks. When the bank stops giving the money to pay the salaries of the people who make the decisions, it'll close." And sure,
shareholders had...
As long as the banks would lend the money, the people who were making the decision up the top were still receiving their income.
Shareholders didn't really have...
Shareholders didn't have that kind of control over it. I think this is so much true.
Subsidiary or a small part of a larger organization?
Tiny little
so they
part.
Didn't realize it was a loss-making component of a large organization.
It was very, it's part of an enormous inter-global sort of multinational thing. Hmm. But there were lots of closures. The closures of the little maternity hospitals around the place had been going on since the 1970s. They'd been shutting those down. And that was, I think, basically just... caused by better transport and ability to get people into bigger hospitals.
An ongoing trend with hospitals. You could have better quality care in the larger hospitals.
Exactly, so that the days when people didn't have enough a car to get you there were long gone.
Yeah.
And for emergencies, they could even get you there by a helicopter and so forth. There was that. There were a lot of factory closures. Levin had a number of outfits that made caravans under subsidy, and they closed down.
This was an interesting issue because a lot of people were saying to Muldoon when he was prime minister, he was very interventionist, And they were saying, no, we need to move more towards market competition and so on. We shouldn't have all the protection. And it was at the situation where companies were saying, we want to produce this. We have to go to the government, get a permission. They'll apply import controls to avoid the competition and tell us what price we charge goods at.
It's so ironic at the time that we thought Muldoon was a right-winger. Now he looks very left-wing compared to what happened under the Labour government that followed him.
That's right, because what they said was, you know, you've got to free things up. And he picked on the caravan industry. Because this is a small one. I'll show them how wrong they are. We'll immediately remove all protection. The industry collapsed. And he said, so you see, this is why we should carry on with what we're doing. Yeah.
It just grew. There was a long strike at the Rixon textiles thing there where the women did this enormous long sit-in. I remember doing a number of stories on that. Out at Shannon, there was Fiber Makers, which shut down, and 85 jobs lost in Shannon. It was a big blow to the community. And the really huge one, of course, came later when Longburn's Dairy Factory closed down. I think that was something like 1,600 jobs gone from Palmerston North. So an awful lot of this stuff was carrying on right through from the early 80s.
So you covered the closure, or you could follow up on the social impacts afterwards?
All of that. And even things like, I remember over at the railway yards in Maunganui, the East Town railway yards, the Labour government that came in, the fourth Labour government, had as its Minister of Railways Richard Preble. And I interviewed him there when they were doing a thing called the Save Rail campaign while Muldoon was trying to turn it into an SOE sort of thing, I think, and so forth. And he said to me, no, they'll be all right. They're going to have a Labour government. And they got one, and Richard Preble became the demon who was
who closed it down
in the end. I can remember the story I did with him there, they'll be all right, only made today, tonight, in the regional news. But they used that, they'll be all right, they've got a Labour government on network a couple of years later when he went and closed the railway shop workshop down. So there was a lot of stuff going on like that.
If you were involved in reporting on this, what was the reaction? Because it did seem people voted out Muldoon, voted in Labour, expected something going to the left, and Labour actually came out with far more right-wing policies than the National
Government. They were hugely in debt. I think that drove a lot of it. The debt was enormous. It was kind of hard to see from here, basically, what I was dealing with. I didn't understand the bigger picture at all at the time. Mm. It's only looking back that you get wiser. But there certainly was an awful lot of feeling of, we're in trouble out here, you know, right through the 80s. But there was fun stuff, too. I can remember, for example, doing more than one bits of jet boat racing through the Manawatu Gorge, because when they had the marathon that went around the country every 4 years, I think we had the world jet boat competitions. And they loved to go through the Manawatu Gorge because the White Horse Rapids there were such a challenge. That was fun. Another thing like that I remember is going down near Levin to Forest Lakes and doing a chap who was off to the World Barefoot Skiing Championships. That was a kind of funny thing because we shot all this film of him behind the boat kicking up this huge cloud of water with his bare
water
feet.
Water skiing.
And I realized just before we left, you couldn't see his bare feet. You couldn't tell he didn't have skis on.
Yeah.
And I said this to everybody in the boat as we were going back. And he said, oh, is that all the problem? And he said, no, you're not allowed to film. The boat mustn't show in this. And I said, okay. And he stepped over the side of the boat. We were doing about 20 miles an hour, holding on to the side of the boat and stood there on his bare feet while we filmed him. And we got the shots that showed he was actually barefoot skiing. But he said, this is totally illegal. We're not allowed to do it.
Yeah, okay.
So there were fun times too. The big change for me technically came in 1985 when they decided to shift over from film to electronic news gathering. And that gave me an extra 2 hours a day because I didn't have to wait for the film to be developed.
Yeah, when so it's digital, you mean?
ENG, yeah. Electronic News Gathering, was videotape, yeah.
Okay.
All sorts of things happened. Cricket became a lot more fun to film. We were allowed 10 minutes of film. Pick 10 minutes out of a cricket match and try to get something salient happening. But with the videotape, we could just let it run until something happened and then go. Mm. So that got a lot easier. Also, too, I didn't have to wait for that development time down there, so I thought I'd have a lot more time to shoot my film. Turned out I was wrong about that, because what they did when they got the extra time was they put it into what they called production values. This is the time when we were shifting over. If there's anything I personally would use to describe Rogernomics, is a change from what I called more and more packaging on less and less product.
Mm.
And what that meant to me in television is that I didn't get any more time to create the product. We spent more time editing the film.
Yeah.
And you think about it.
So the product's the recording. And
the product's the raw material. Yeah. It just got cuter and cuter and fancier and fancier. Mm. You could do all sorts of things with videotape you couldn't do with film. It's the same time that we went from having one newsreader sitting there straight, looking very formal. I remember Dougal Stevenson, who everybody remembers from the news, but probably didn't realize. He was sitting there in a pair of Bermuda shorts and jandals with his coat and his tie on above it and so forth. From that very formal, strict sort of thing into this chatty, Brian Edwards called the Kuchiku News, where you had a male and a female chatting back and forth to each other and exchanging quips and stuff.
Infotainment. Sort of.
Exactly. And that was happening during the late 80s on that came in.
So do you think that made the news less informative?
Oh, gosh, yes. Much less content in it. Yeah. It takes time to chat, you know.
Yeah.
And just the reduction, for example, when they got rid of the regional news, in the days of the regional news, nationwide, reporters went out and did 40 stories a day. Once we dropped the regional news, we lost 8.
Reporters did 40?
40 stories a day, nationwide.
Each one doing two stories.
Each one doing one story.
Right, one story.
You'd have about 8 stories today, tonight. You'd have another 8 stories up in Auckland on their program. You'd have 8 in Christchurch. You'd have 8 in... So there were... That plus 8 in the regional news, there were 40 stories being covered in New Zealand every day.
Okay.
When we dropped the regional news, we only did the 8. For the network news.
Okay.
So we just, everywhere, what happened where you were, of course, is you heard the 8 stories on your regional news and then the 8 stories. You got 16 stories a day. Mm. All of a sudden you got 8. So less product.
Yeah.
Again, more packaging, the people chatting and all
for
stuff.
For historical purposes, then the record would be that much.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Disappeared. I don't know if you can even actually get Today Tonight film now. I suspect it's probably being thrown away.
Right,
I don't know. But we certainly had a library then that kept it all.
Yeah.
We just got these elaborate studio settings, you know, the sort of things now where you've got this kind of round room that somebody is standing up in and all this kind of palaver instead of actual content.
Yes. Yeah.
If you go back and look at a news bulletin from the 1984, you will find it very hard to understand because so many facts are coming at you so fast.
Okay.
And we're just not capable of taking it in anymore. Yeah, we didn't have any trouble then.
Lost the concentration.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
But do you find then that radio still has more... So balancing it, have more content through radio?
There's not much local news on radio either.
Yeah,
it's just network news, you know. If you live in Auckland, you know when there's a road blockage somewhere, you can't get to work. But, you know, the Manawatu Bridge would have to collapse before you would hear it on radio here.
And the commercial stations don't have any of their own news?
They don't have any staff. They don't have any staff.
So they just tap into national?
They just basically, that's about all there is. In the late 80s, when I ran into this, I thought, well, I've got the electronic news gathering. The wonderful thing about the videotape is you could just transmit by wire.
Yeah.
yes, or by audio visual. Yeah. You don't even need a wire. You can do it by wireless. Mm. And I managed to talk the regional editor into setting up a link out at Massey University and studio out there, so we could go live from there. Well, I think we used it for one or two local body elections, sort of thing, on election night.
So there's a TV studio there rather than one in town?
Yeah, well, all it was an ability to take you could go out there and do an interview with somebody and it would go straight through to Wellington. Or you could go out there with your videotape and they could play it through to Wellington. That was going to be a huge thing. It turned out it didn't work very well because I found nobody down there was very much interested in editing your stuff or anything. Yeah. So I still had to drive down and do it. So as the 80s went on, I got less and less optimistic. found it harder and harder to do. So by the time, the other thing they did was that they decided to spend all their money on. All the money that was being spent regional news was redirected into paying for a share of a satellite with Channel 9 in Sydney. Mm-hmm. And the cost of that was huge. They had a new director general of television, a chap named Julian Mounter, who was very much an internationalist and who really didn't care about what he called parish pump news. Mm-hmm. He wanted to get instant global news here. He was English.
Was that important too, though? You think global news coverage was satisfactory here before?
Well, I think it was a day slower. But I can remember one of my cohort colleagues at work once who wasn't in the newsroom, was doing current affairs, saying to me, people don't really need to know that a new supermarket has opened on Tuesday. If they hear on Wednesday, they'll still be all right. So that gaining a day, I think we threw away an awful lot more than we lost, by that. We did have, of course, we didn't have the pictures, is the thing, and TV lives by pictures. So if there was a typhoon in Japan, you couldn't see the people being swept out to sea. Mm. We just had a newsreader saying it. Yeah. So that was the difference. But we traded for that. We traded knowing what's going on in our own community. Hmm. And to me, that's a huge imbalance.
Well, there's another dimension, too, I think. If you, the idea of news is something immediate, then so much of what you might need to know to be informed isn't some sensational immediate event. It's far more an understanding of general things that evolve over time.
Yeah. There was an effort back when I was doing radio by a chap in charge of Radio New Zealand News to develop the slogan of news you can use. Mm. But we found it to be pretty much an ideal that you couldn't live up to. There is a little bit of news you can use. For example, if you have really terrible weather, that's news you can use.
So you mean informative to help people make better
decisions?
Yeah,
about what their own lives at that time.
Okay.
But the vast bulk of news that you hear doesn't actually. I mean, I'm an American, so I've been obsessive about the hearings that have been going on with President Trump and impeachment and everything like that, and I've been watching them. But it's not going to affect me one little bit here in New Zealand. Well, hopefully not, anyway. So it's really hard to find. Most of the news is news we want to hear, rather than news we actually have some use for. Mm. It shapes our lives in the longer run. But I think we need to know the detail.
Investigative reporting, which they say that has died out a lot. Was there much more of that? Is that in radio? Did you have a chance?
No, there wasn't. There's always been current affairs, but in news, no. And in fact, one of the changes that came in with the switch over to the Kuchiku News was we were given
the chat shows.
Yeah. When we were planning to do it, and we were basically going to do it in response, TV3 is coming and we've got to be better and they'll be sensationalist, we'll have to. They gave us two options. They brought out a chap from the BBC in London to show us what the BBC did, and they did more in-depth they were going to do more in-depth stuff. And so that was taken on board, and we do actually do more in-depth stuff. But I think it became more commentary stuff rather than actual investigative stuff. The other thing they did was they brought out a chap named Fred Shook from the University of Colorado to show us what America was doing. And they were doing what I basically call, you know, the sort of blood and guts sensationalist sort of stuff. I can remember, for example, he showed us this film of a terrible weather event in on the Carolina coast. And there were these three small houses they'd been, just totally flattened up on this hill. And he had an old black guy who was the grandfather of this family and had lost almost all his descendants wandering through the rubble with this very, very handsome reporter. And Porter is picking up and showing, holding up pictures of his families from off the wall and stuff and getting him to look at it and so forth. And then the reporter says, "How do you feel?" And the poor guy is in tears, you know. And there was this stunned silence afterwards among the reporters who were watching it. And I stupidly, I think this was the stage at which it became very clear that I was not going to last in the organization. I blurted out, "I don't do that sort of thing." Professor Shook said, "Well, he agreed to the interview." And I said, "I wouldn't I wouldn't do that if he did." And
well, that's like the, what was it, when Mount St. Helens went up and they interviewed one old guy living halfway up the mountain saying, "I'm never going to leave." And they said, well, that was probably his death sentence. Because how could he do that?
Yeah. And it does have an awful lot of attractiveness to you. I mean, you stop in your tracks and watch something like that. You can't help it. And that's the change from that ideal that we couldn't realize, the news you can use, to the much, much lesser one, I think, of the news as bait for advertising.
And push
emotional buttons. Basically, if the job of news on radio and television and in newspapers is to get readership or listeners so that advertisers will pay you a lot of money, I don't want to be around it anyhow, you know.
Now, there's one aspect with, now I suppose you probably have a different term for it, but you get on Morning Report or whatever, the interview, they're interviewing a politician and they digging and asking awkward questions. Was there any of that? Is that reporting or is
that
it the sort
that
of thing
confrontational
that
sort of style? Definitely predates that changeover I've been talking about. I can remember, I can't even remember his name, but he was a young South African reporter that we had out here who did very hostile, aggressive interviews, and it was very, very popular in terms of it was attractive, good TV, as they say again, you know, sort of thing. But it's devolved to the States now where you've basically got networks that have chosen sides. Are simply trying to stir up their own supporters of the sort of thing. It reminds me of the kind of stuff political parties do. The job of news is to do the kind of stuff political parties do, I'm not sure we can justify having news.
But do you find if you're reporting that the people might be reluctant to answer questions honestly, or they're trying
definitely places where there are questions you don't like to ask, but you feel you've got to. I can remember, for example, a terrible thing that happened down near Levin, where a farmer had piled up all this scrub he'd cut, dried it out, and set fire to it. And unfortunately, the paddock he was in had peat underneath, and that caught fire. And consequently, smoke from it drifted across Highway 1. For weeks, they just couldn't get the fire out. And a woman got confused driving through there, got on the wrong side of the road and got killed. And I had to go do a story about this. And afterwards, after I finished interviewing viewing the farmer, he said, "This isn't the sort of stuff that you should be doing." And all I could say is, well, it happened, you know. and we can't pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah.
So I think there's places where you do have to do hard lines.
Yeah.
But you don't do them because they're attractive to watch.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, that's
what about with politicians then, or calling people to account? Speak truth to power.
Yes. I think, you know, if you take the parallel from the courts, reporters have an official legal place in court reporting. You are there as a representative of the people, and consequently they cannot close you out. They can close you reporting it out.
Okay.
They can say you're not allowed to say this person's name or something, but they can't make you leave the court. You have a right to stay there.
Okay.
That has been limited to some extent. I can remember actually getting thrown out of court once like that when I had a very bad lawyer and they had a very good one. But generally, that's a principle, and I think there's a place for the news there as a representative of the public. But you have to remember that you're not there for the news outlet.
Yes.
You're there for the people who are watching the news. And that's a huge conflict when you're doing things because it's going to be good for your corporation rather than it's going to be good for your profession, then you're not being professional.
Yeah.
You know, that's like a doctor who's trying to increase the income for his hospital.
Yeah.
And that's not a doctor's job either.
Yeah. Now, so you've done court, we've just got a couple of minutes, but you've done court reporting. One thing that seems interesting about often the headlines about court reporting these days is that, you know, the lawyer asked this question, or the lawyer said the witness was lying. Well, that's not the evidence. The evidence is the person's response. So why is the lawyer's tactic to try and evince some evidence for the jury, why is that the news rather than the response?
Well, if you consider the job of the news to be attracting attention so that you can increase your listening audience so that you can get more money for the ads you sell from the advertisers, then that's the way you go.
Yeah.
That's why you do that. And under neoliberal sort of logic, under the market phenomenon, that's the job of your job actually is to think about your shareholders.
And it's giving people a false impression.
You're not actually working for the audience. Yeah. You're working for the people who have shares in the company. And so long as we're doing that, then to my mind, we're letting.
And that might undermine people's understanding of the operation of the
certainly law. Undermines respect for the news.
Yeah,
we don't trust the media anymore, and that's why I think we've learned not to trust them, because they haven't been trustworthy.
Yeah.
So we shot ourselves in the foot that way.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.